There's no time for us. There's no place for us. What is this thing that builds our dream, yet slips away from us? To live forever. Who wants to live forever? Ooh. There's no chance for us. It's all decided. This world has only one sweet moment set aside for us. Who wants to live forever? Who wants to live forever? So touch my tears with your lips, touch my world with your fingertips, and we can have forever, and we can love forever. Who waits forever anyway?
Hello, my name is Marjorie Wingrove, and I'm the host of Death Happens, broadcast through the facilities of Trent Radio 92.7 CFFF. I've created this show as a way to normalize the conversation around death-related topics. Death is inevitable for every living thing. I believe knowledge and preparation can create some comfort and peace of mind. Please bear with us during today's episode. There are a few sound issues. I hope that won't interfere too much with your listening pleasure. I am completely honored to have with me as my guest today, Rami Shammy. Rami Shammy has been serving within hospice palliative care for over 3 decades. He feels privileged to currently practice as a consultant as well as a case manager for the Second Mile Club at Kensington Health and the Multicultural Outreach Coordinator for Lighthouse for Grieving Children, while harvesting a conviction that everyone should have access to quality hospice palliative care. Rami strongly advocates and supports the development and growth of programs and services for those traveling the journey of a life-limiting illness, their caregivers, and those who are bereaved.
So welcome, Rami Shami, to Death Happens.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It certainly does happen, doesn't it?
It does. So first, for the benefit of listeners, could you tell me what you're working on right now? There are so many things that you do. You know, as I'm looking through your bios and your blogs, I'm like...
Yeah, it's very grateful, very humbled. And, you know, stuff just, some just comes out and just presents itself to you. And like, yeah, I can engage in this. I can support this. And so much of it, actually, if we can even back up further, it's the intentionality behind it. It's not so much self-marketing or even personal interest. It's just, where can we help? Where can we grow awareness? Where can we support? Where can we provide deeper, more expansive measures to support people? And absolutely, the projects that I'm working on, actually the domains that I'm working on right now cover quite the continuum from, you know, diversity, multiculturalism, equity, inclusivity in children's grief, to trauma-informed care and hospice palliative care, which right now is it's gaining a lot of traction. I'm teaching a lot of trauma-informed care within hospice palliative care settings, but it's still a lot of resistance in terms of this approach, and engage in a lot of anti-racism, anti-oppression, culture humility aspects of death care. Yeah, we might be even doing some work with a gentleman down in the U.S. about some of the trauma that the Armenian priests are experiencing. Armenian priests are experiencing in Europe due to the war. So we're trying to implement or infuse some trauma-informed training and education among the pastors and priests here so that they can support their colleagues over there. So yeah, lots of little projects here and there. And then of course the mainstay of, you know, the work that I do with Kensington and Lighthouse. So yeah, we're a little busy.
What I've been, you know, we're on Facebook together, and what I've been seeing from so many of your posts is just how you, as a person working in hospice and healthcare and all the different things you do, how you are, what's even the word? Well, you thrive as a person generally. I was going to use the word cope, but you're a thriver.
I think sometimes they go hand in hand. Learn how to cope and you might thrive, right? And I think those can be aligned closely.
But the pandemic obviously is having a huge impact on your life in work, and without getting personal, but your personal life. I know that you've been not always at home during this in order to keep your family safe.
Oh, you saw that post. Absolutely. That was a very trying time, actually. I'm primary caregiver for two older adults. My parents both have longstanding illnesses, long chronic illnesses, and my dad's somewhat in a palliative trajectory. But yeah, and I mean, the work that I do at frontline as caregiver support, bedside companion in a hospice, I had to kind of leave them to their own devices and find, you know, my own place. But I mean, I was pretty homeless, you might say, living out of my car and at Airbnbs, which brought its own challenges in terms of, you know, being able to have access to my daughter. So that was a whole other issue, because there was some dynamics there. Now, we do what we need to do to safeguard the people we love. We had 8 or 9 deaths at our long-term care facility at Kensington. So we had to really safeguard ourselves. Vaccines weren't out. We were just implementing temperature checks. And it was a very trying time. I thrive on compassion and empathy. I feel like I'm well-versed in the experiences of trauma, especially with my childhood development and all that kind of stuff. What really, like you used the words, was thriving and coping. I found ways to cope. I found ways to remain focused on what was important in my life. That fueled an intentionality that ended up being maybe appearing as thriving. But yeah, I find if there is opportunity in almost everything to redefine your life and redefine your perspective. And I absolutely adore what I do. I love what I do. So it wasn't easy to make that shift. But yeah, it was a little rough time there in about 4 or 5 months, for sure.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering which direction to take this now.
What stirs in your heart and mind? Where's the gravity?
What I'm gravitating towards is, what I haven't had is the opportunity to connect with strangers who are at the end of their life. And I'm wondering if you can share with the listeners some of the experience you have with that.
Oh, where do you want me to begin? It's been 3 decades. I'll just speak from the heart. I think it's really interesting today, everything that's happening today, not just COVID, but racism, diversity, gender specificity, the trauma, like there's so much that's coming and being brought to light as a result of our focus on end of life, that it's really changed the landscape of end of life death care or end of life perspectives. What I saw even 10 years ago, let alone 20 or 30 years ago, was a very exclusive, almost an exclusive sort of a club of what end of life was supposed to look like, who was supposed to take care of people, who came to be served at end of life, how we died. It's so different now. What I mean by it's different, it's just there's a lot more influences from diversity. There's a little bit more focus on equity. And what I mean by that is that, like, for example, hospices, for the most part, until recently, right, where there's, you know, now Port Perry has one and Cornwall has one, Scarborough has one in terms of hospices or hospice residences. Hospice palliative care programs were built in affluent neighborhoods because they can be supported by communities that had money. So much has changed in terms of the accessibility to support and services at end of life. And that's changed who comes, and it's changed what we receive and what we see at end of life from the people that are coming and being served. So I've been really fortunate because now, you know, I do a lot of work with people experiencing homelessness, structural vulnerability, and even Indigenous peoples who are being served at end of life. Whereas before, for multitude of reasons, I mean, some hospices are still calling themselves residential hospices, which we're advocating strongly to change that name. But now, I mean, what I'm having the fortune of seeing is this diversity being expressed in end of life. I thought I knew something. I've been doing this for a long time. Man, you just keep learning. People are very unique and individual depending who they are, what they come from, what their experiences of traumas, backgrounds. It's so many influences that today there's such a focus on diversifying how we do end of life, you know, and that doing is in how we die, where we die, and who cares for us when we're dying. And that doing is being changed literally by the day, you know, and I'm very fortunate. I feel kind of on the cusp of that in environments like palliative care units or hospices, like palliative care unit in Trinidad or hospices here, to see how we can change our accessibility, change our culture, change even what color we paint the walls so that it's more accommodating and appropriate, or recognizing how we do death care can be traumatizing or re-traumatizing and look at our biases. So I feel like there's an explosion of knowledge right now. There's still, honestly, there's pockets of really constricted, narrow, focused, exclusive areas within end-of-life care. But there's a lot of push to, for a lack of a trauma-informed word, is to blow it up, right? And really look at it from an inclusive lens. It's pretty cool. I'm really lucky to be at the age I am, and the health that I am, in the opportunities I am to be doing this. And we haven't even started talking about the pandemic. And I tell this to a lot of people coming to death care or to hospice palliative care from, I say them separately, because I'll be straight with you, I'll be transparent. Hospice palliative care isn't the most welcoming to other forms of death care, and for a number of reasons, okay? Like, for example, death doulas and end-of-life doulas and thanat doulas and all that kind of stuff. But if you look at the COVID right now and the pandemic and how it's really shone a light on some of the barriers that exist to supporting people in hospice residence, for example, infection control, essential visitors, essential caregivers, all these pieces that come with COVID, or even the disenfranchising of grief because people can't be at bedside, people can't necessarily have the funerals or the wakes or the celebrations of life. Hospice palliative care used to pride itself that we're so different. We do these celebration of life and these beautiful processions. Well, COVID changed all that. It forced us, and many of us didn't adapt or really were nimble enough to dance with it, to adapt to what happens when you can't do that which you are taking pride in and are customary within the culture of hospice palliative care. What happens to your identity as a social service movement or as a service when you can't do A, B, C, D, all the way up to X? What can you do? Where's the creativity? And that's what's, I think, changing a lot of end-of-life care right now. Honestly, I could go on for a long time about it because there's so much that's happening to it.
I think a lot of people have the romantic vision of hospice, a place to go and be comfortable at the end of a life and, you know, being well taken care of, you know, maybe have your dog come and visit. Something I see in Peterborough is there's a huge amount of poverty here, homelessness. When I was growing up here, downtown was pretty cute and, you know, there was a new mall downtown and it was all pretty great. Maybe there was a busker or two. And now at every corner, there's somebody asking for a handout. I do my best. I'm not carrying cash anymore. I'm not going out as much as I used to, but I do my best to try to remember to have something with me when I do go out. But there's also a lot of drug use here, considering the small population. And it's very visible. There's a youth shelter downtown. So what goes through my mind as far as helping this community that I've just moved to less than 2 years ago is how to provide death education and death care and some kind of end of life. I'm not familiar yet with the community. I haven't immersed myself in the death care community here yet. I think as a doula, there's a ton I can offer to the disenfranchised who are here. As you're talking about that, I just think more and more about, it's like, there's got to be a way to do that. There are the restraints from being in the middle of pandemic.
Yeah, it's interesting what has happened with Peterborough, within Peterborough, in terms of poverty, substance use, and homelessness and all that. Something that I learned working with people experiencing homelessness and receiving a palliative approach in Toronto is that oftentimes, and not in every case, oftentimes their view of death is different, right? And my experiences have been that they have taught me more about death than I was to teach them. Here I am coming in as the person who does end of life stuff, right? In hospice for a long time. And they're like, death? I see a death every day. I know what? I'm close to death every day, whether I'm using some substance or I'm trying to survive on the street, right? You're going to talk to me about death care? It's so interesting because what I learned in terms of working with people, especially people experiencing homelessness, is how death care and hospice especially isn't built and structured in provision of services. For example, hospice residences look lovely and all this, but people can very much get triggered, experience re-traumatization in being in a place that doesn't fit the familiarity that they're used to. Or a lot of hospice residences are abstinence models. So how do you take somebody who's been using substances their entire life to cope? They go into a hospice residence and they're with compassionate, loving, empathetic people, and they're told, you can't do that anymore to cope. So I learned, you know, and I say this hopefully kindly and sensitively, I felt I was being almost arrogant, you know, or egotistical to think that I can go to these people who are receiving a palliative approach and teach them about death care, when in fact, it wasn't so much a teaching or a sharing, it was actually more supporting of their identity, their individuality, their sense of choice, their a voice and advocacy for their services where they are not being supported. I think that's where you and I and people like ourselves can really have an impact within death care when it's referencing people experiencing homelessness and trauma and substance use and all that, is the advocacy piece. Let's stop thinking that we can take what we know about death care and tell them about it. Let's listen to what they really need and then change how we do things to support and align with what they need and what they want, which can be different from other and can be very much the same in many ways. I'll give you an example. You know, a hospice that I was working at, a residence, like this individual, he was Indigenous. And at night, you know, he's used to being up at night. Yeah, he uses substances, trauma, partying, all, you know, alcohol and all that kind of stuff. But he's such an intellectual, intelligent, engaging individual. But in his experience of homelessness, and he came to die at the residence, he'd get up and walk around at night. So they labeled him as a wanderer. And so they were, the nursing staff and PSWs felt he was a threat. He's wandering at night. So well, with homelessness and structural vulnerability and his Indigenous roots, maybe there's a transient nature to him to move about, to seek shelter from where he can seek it. Maybe it's historical, intergenerational. Maybe it's who and what he is, right? So they came up with this brilliant idea to put a yellow barrier on his door so that he didn't get out. I'm like, you're taking somebody who's Indigenous, who's lived on the streets, who has coping mechanisms that are outside the norm of what you would consider acceptable at the hospice, and you want to put a yellow barrier? I mean, isn't it enough? You know, and the trauma that people have experiencing, people who are Indigenous have experienced, what are you doing? And so they're like, oh, okay. And then so they put a PSW on night just to support his wandering. Okay. And he was like harmless. He loved people. But you see, it comes even, you know, when we take the experts in the field to even look at their implicit and unconscious biases when it comes to serving people experiencing homelessness within a hospice residence, right? Or on the streets, or in settings that we would not consider conducive to death and dying. We've had people leave the residence and go back out on the street, you know, because that's where they felt comfortable. For me, I changed it from what I can think I could teach them to what I think I can provide in terms of advocacy, support, choice, and changing the way we support people who literally see death every day, right? On the streets of our cities, whether it's Peterborough, Oshawa, Toronto, Kitchener, Waterloo.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Everything you just said just resonates with me so deeply. Good. Just 100%. It's been a few years. I relinquished my, I relinquished judgment for things I didn't understand. And I became better acquainted with that part of society that I wasn't raised in. And for me, it becomes about, in life, it becomes about harm reduction and advocacy. And like you say, you know, people do see death all the time. And we don't really think about that, you know, unless you work in it, people don't see death every day. And maybe that's why people are afraid to talk about it, because they're not familiar with it. But yeah, exactly what you said is to be able to have the give and take and use what I know to be able to help them through it.
And really, I think, well said, I think also to be present with how someone else sees the world. So if we're going to focus a little bit on people experiencing homelessness, it could be very soon that they experience homelessness, or they could have been on the street for 30 years. So homelessness is such a continuum. But that being said, for example, some of the individuals I've had the honor and privilege of supporting who were on the streets for quite some time, who lived rough for quite some time, it's not so much that death and dying that scared them. What they communicated to me was the care and compassion is what scared them. It's a lack of trust in it. Who are you? Why are you here? Why are you supporting me? Why am I in this place? Why do you give a shit? Why do I have to be dying? You know, and I believe Dr. Stajahar out in BC or in Calgary did all this research on it. Why do I have to be dying for you to care, right? Where were you 3-4 years ago when I was homeless and I was able to walk around and do my own thing and not dying in this bed? So that's another perspective, right? Be compassion and empathy, maybe from experiences of trauma or maybe from visitations to emergency rooms and re-traumatization, or even the very fact of why are you caring now that I'm dying is perplexing. Right. And that can result in relational mistrust with the care providers, whoever they may be, regardless of how empathetic and compassionate and caring we are or we think we are. Because compassion and empathy is thought, okay, and I think it's misguided many times, is that we're kind, we're soft, we're loving, we're all these kinds of things. But that's not actually the truest definition of compassion, right? Compassion, passion is a feeling, is being able to relate, not understand, but relate and maybe align with how somebody else is feeling. To perceive it, to recognize it, to acknowledge, to validate it. That's compassion, in at least in my perspective. And that's not always, oh, I care about you. I love you. I will do anything for you. It's not that crap, right? I mean, sorry to call it crap, but it can oftentimes trigger people who are in a state of being triggered by it.
Condescension. That's not compassion.
And it builds hierarchy, right? And so when somebody in that particular mindset is, and this is so interesting, how quickly compassion and empathy can turn to resentment, right? When that compassion or empathy, as it's expressed, is pushed back on in mistrust or distrust, watch what happens to that compassion and empathy, okay? So that's just a little bit of my soapbox. Just keeping it real, right?
That's what I brought you for.
Oh, by all means, I appreciate it. I appreciate the forum, trust me. I think it's changing. I think it's changing. It's like pulling teeth. Like I've worked in some in hospice palliative care programs where it's really hard to implement the trauma-informed approach. It's hard to even speak about cultural humility because people, like, we're stuck in this cultural competence. Let's see how Muslims do death. Let's see how Jews do death. Let's see how somebody's gay does death, right? And there's a lack of self-reflection. You know, when this program that you have, it's really a culturally, it truly, what I know you recognize, it's a culturally humble approach because it involves an opportunity for people to self-reflect, right? And that's why I align with it, right? You're giving people an opportunity by what you present and share knowledge of is to self-reflect on who and what they are. How do they see the world, right? How do they interface and engage the world? And what footprint do they leave on that world, right? In terms of a legacy. And that's what needed in all aspects of end-of-life care, or even in our own dying, right?
Yeah. People who I've met as somebody who's studying end-of-life care have been are some of the most profoundly self-examining people I've ever met. The mindfulness is strong, and what we give to living is so strong and deep.
The irony of this is that I've seen the opposite. I feel that the self-reflective practice of death kind of almost pulls it out of us, right? So I know if you've heard of Michael Murphy, he said in his book, until we have experientially examined the time of our own dying, the thought may be too anxiety provoking to be as one with another who needs our assistance. What he's really trying to say, I think, is if you don't even look at the fact of you're going to die, your mortality, your transient nature in every single moment, because we die to every moment, literally, then even being with somebody else at end of life can be very anxiety provoking, right? It can cause a great deal of anxiety and ungroundedness. And since death is all around us, I think that's a big part of the trauma of the pandemic, is that literally the vulnerability and threat is all around us. And it's not just like March, it's not just about end of life of our bodies, but end of life of our marriages, end of life of our work, end of life of our careers, end of life of our, I mean, I'm going to turn 50 this year, and it just hit me kind of like, oh, wait a minute. It's an end of life. And I think for me, how I've lived my life is constantly in that self-reflective of an ending and not so much a beginning, but constant endings, right? And where do I stand in that? But unfortunately, Marge, just because people work in death care and hospice palliative care doesn't necessarily invoke self-reflection. Actually, sometimes and many times it invokes the opposite. I would say a repression to what is right in front of them, and almost a dishonoring of the sacredness of what it means to be alive and to know that you're going to die.
That's fascinating. And I'm really glad that I haven't yet been disillusioned.
I've been in the field for so long. I came in as a bright-eyed, bushy-tailed youngster, right? And had this altruistic view of death care. And unfortunately, I've been disillusioned many, many a times. But within the disillusionment, within the moments of living out of your car while you're still trying to protect your family, your kids, and serve people who are, you know, at end of life, spawns forth an authenticity of perspective. And why we gravitate to one particular sense of altruistic expression. And when you realize you're in disillusionment, you also realize what brought you to it and how inauthentic it was, which spawns forth a different truth about yourself, right? I mean, now I know why I'm in this work and why I was in it and why I love it and what legacy I want to leave. That's the beauty of disillusionment. I'm going to write an article on it. You and I came up with it, the beauty of disillusionment.
I like it very much. Okay. Oh, Rami.
Thanks, Marge, for having me on. Just stay well and safe. Keep this going.
I don't want to say goodbye, but...
Hold on 1 second. Sam, come here for a second. I'll let my kids say my goodbye for me, all right?
Oh, yeah.
Hello.
She's the youngest hospice volunteer as she started when she was still a baby. She's been to almost every hospice I've ever worked at.
Except one. Because I had
it. No, we went to that one too.
No, the other one.
All right. All right. Thanks, Marge.
Thank you.
You take care.
This is the last episode of the spring season for Death Happens. I'm going to be taking a bit of a hiatus to figure out what the next steps are, how the show will look beyond this, and really what is the next incarnation for Death Happens, so to speak. We've covered a lot of topics in the last few weeks, but there is still so much more to talk about. Let's keep the conversation going. Here is Queen's The Show Must Go On, sung by a friend of Rami's, Claude Paquette. My name is Marjorie Wingrove. This has been Death Happens. Thank you so much for listening. And I